off having Lori Warner come up. And we did a blind survey, and I think you all have the results from that. They should have been, I think they were given to you the other day, so that hopefully you've had a chance to look them over. And this was, the responses were tallied by Kelly and Jim, by Kelly, and and she did a terrific job, because what she did was she made all of the answers available on this, it says DAS survey responses, and she made them all basically verbatim, not basically, but she made them verbatim responses. And the other thing that she did is that, if I'm not mistaken, and Kelly can correct me if I'm wrong, but for example, response one on question one and response one on question two are off of the same survey. So whatever survey it came off of, that's the number that it corresponds. But unless the agencies were asked to give us the responses, and it was a true blind survey from the standpoint that we didn't know what agencies responded. We did not know, we just didn't know what agencies responded. Now, there's a couple of answers where the agency actually alluded to us in their answer who they were, and that there wasn't anything we could do about that, except that I don't think that Kelly put any of that part of the response in, so we still don't know who the agency was that responded. And we really wanted to make this a blind survey. We provided a copy of the survey responses to Ms. Warner, so that she could look them over. And And then I have written out some issues and some concerns that I have with regards to it. But we wanted to give Lori kind of a chance to talk to us a little bit about this and answer concerns that we may have around it. And then there's a couple of things that I would also like to address with the Department of Administrative Services, and that is what they're doing in terms of a strategic plan, and then also in customer service. Customer service was one of those areas that was kind of some of the agencies were critical of in their responses. So with that, Lori, I don't know if you have any opening comments that you want to make, or
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the Acting Director for Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Chair, I had three or four questions that were given to me that you wanted addressed in this committee, so I thought I would start with those questions first, and then maybe we can do follow-up if that works for you.
That would be terrific. Is that the questions about... Oh. Let's see, which is that going? Is that going to be this one right here?
Okay. The questions I had, Mr. Chair, were what initiatives has DAS reviewed as a means to save revenue or other resources for agencies? How does DAS evaluate and rate customer service to state agencies? Does DAS have a strategic plan? If not, describe why it's not been completed. And then what services does DAS see as enterprise level?
Great.
So those are the ones I have written comments on, if that works for you.
That would be terrific, yeah.
Okay. So to begin with, the first question was, what other initiatives has DAS reviewed as a means to save revenue or resources for agencies in the state? And I think this was a follow-up, because Tuesday you heard from Duke and Patty about strategic sourcing. So I'm assuming beyond strategic sourcing, what other things is the department looking at to deal with enterprise-wide savings?
That is correct. That's the text or the context of that.
So, I heard part of the testimony regarding strategic sourcing, which of course this biennium was started last biennium, but the results were reaping this biennium in terms of savings to state agencies. DAS, of course, looks at those opportunities all the time and determines which one we have the highest payoff in terms of starting initiatives in from a business case perspective, and then determining what kind of resources we have to work on these things. And as you saw from strategic sourcing, you have to invest some money first to be able to save the money in terms of changing systems and how we're approaching doing purchasing. We needed to invest some money with a consultant in order to make those changes. So the next big item on the department's agenda is the project in the Information Resource Management Division, which is the Computing and Network Infrastructure Consolidation Project, which is known as CNIC. So that project has been discussed with the Joint Legislative Information Management Committee in the interim, and then here in front of the House's Information Management Technology. It's also being discussed in Ways and Means because we will need to change how the 12 agencies' information technology systems function in order to consolidate the data centers. And then after we've invested initially in making those one-time changes, which we see happening in the 05-07 biennium, we project that there will be somewhere in the range of $10 million annually in savings that we would have otherwise been spending with 12 data centers that were decentralized. So that's the next big initiative. And as you're aware, there's a building currently going up that we're constructing to house the data center, and there's been some tours of that facility, and I'm not sure if this committee has seen that or not, but that really is the initiative that for probably 07-09 will result in the type of savings that you currently saw coming from SmartBuy this particular biennium.
Yeah, this committee has not toured the scenic facility. The Information Management Technology Committee, of which I also sit on, did tour it. However, the day that they went on the tour was also one of the days that I was gone, because I was in February. I've kind of missed out on the tour, and I don't know if anybody, either one of my colleagues here are on that committee either. So,
but you know, that type of effort takes a lot of planning on the part of the department and with the rest of state government as we look to change the systems and the way people do business, essentially, and in order to get the business payoff for the state in the long term. You heard Dugan talk.
Well, before you go on that, one other question about the scenic project: is it the intention then that at some point in time, besides the 12 big agencies that are part of that, that the rest of the agencies will eventually be drawn into that and or rolled into it, so that's where their primary computing power is at, and I recognize that there's also the issue of security and redundancy, and that you want your redundant servers to be off-site from where your primary servers are, and all of that kind of stuff.
Mr. Chair, the 12 that were identified to participate are the ones that had the largest computing infrastructure. And so, yes, as we get finished with that, we'll look at other opportunities that the consolidated data center presents for the rest of state government, as well as for the 12 agencies that are currently housed there. So we will be doing that in the 05-07 biennium. Once we have the project up and running, we'll begin to look at what are the other things that could potentially be done here that would save the state money in the long run. And we'll look across state government. We try to look to where it makes the most sense and you can get the most rapid turnaround. And if you take on all 100 agencies at one time, albeit, you know, that would be everybody, it's probably not the most strategic way to go about it in terms of saving resources. So we tend to try to concentrate in certain areas. One of the comments, I think, in the survey you got back from people is, you know, DAS tends to concentrate in that direction, and so small agencies sometimes feel like they get the short straw because we do tend to focus where the dollars are and where we can achieve the greatest savings. Then we come back around in a second wave or a third wave and look at the smaller agencies. But they often do feel that way, and that was one of your comments that you got back from folks.
Right. That was, and that's, and we can talk about that again a little bit later. One of the issues that I had written a note to myself on was relative to to IRMD and the service levels that are, because there were a few agencies that weren't real kind to IRMD, and
true.
And so maybe we can.
We'll come back to that.
We'll come back to it. Yes.
I would mention to you that in just a couple other areas in terms of what activities are going on, some examples to save state dollars. Within DAS, the Oregon Health Policy and Research Group basically provides the cost savings on the Oregon Health Plan because the Health Resource Commission focuses on evidence-based drug work, and we project that saves the state about $8 million per biennium in the Oregon Health Plan by prioritizing which drugs can be used. The Health Services Commission also, under the Oregon Health Plan, prioritizes the list of health services that are going to be paid for under that plan, and that, we believe, saves about $45 million per biennium. So Dr. Bruce Goldberg is the administrator for that particular division that's part of DAS, and that's ongoing work that goes on all the time. The Public Employees Benefit Board, you may be aware, the board has been critically aware of the rising health care costs and the issues around how can the plans be affordable for state government and for employees into the future. They've done a reset of the vision for PEB, and they have been looking also at, under that vision, of how you can structure things so that the costs get not lowered because healthcare costs are rising, of course, but that we can dampen or control those into the future. They're just out with a request for proposal from providers that would do more evidence-based medicine type of activities and see where we can go to, and the results of that are yet to be seen. So the board will be making decisions. What effect that will have on our premium rates in the future, we'll be able to report to you later at some later date. And the State Services Division, when you heard from Dugan about Smart Buy, they have also just implemented the Oregon Procurement Information Network, which is a replacement to the vendor information program that we previously had. It's an online, basically, system for both buyers and sellers of products, and it's supposed to streamline state government and local government procurement and contracting processes. So that was a technology investment that's designed to try to help both sides of the system work more efficiently. So those are just some examples of what's going on. Your next question was, how does DAS evaluate and rate customer service to agencies? You conducted this survey. DAS itself conducts an annual survey, and I think I had mentioned that to you previously, Mr. Chair. The survey asked, and that survey was started in 2003. So the survey asked 11 questions with four possible answers that people can give, always, usually, sometimes, or never, rarely. And the results are compiled and sent to the agency directors so they know, basically, we share that with them so they see what kind of feedback we're getting from agencies. The results for 2004 show that the divisions in DAS largely fall on the positive side of always or usually answers 80 to 90% of the time, except for two divisions, Information Resource Management Division and the Progress Board Division that we have. They fall more at the 50% level in terms of the questions. And some of the questions, I'll give you a couple examples. Are staff professional and courteous? Do staff respond in a timely way? Do staff welcome and listen to input? Those are the types of questions that are really geared to try to figure out how are we interfacing with the folks that we're serving. So we recognize that DAS always, we're providing service and we're also providing controls. So, you know, some of the folks, in terms of getting control answers from us, that you can or can't do certain things, that may not always be something that they want to hear from us. However, we always want staff to be professional and courteous in how they deal with the person that we're serving and look for ways to achieve better results for the agencies. Sometimes we just can't do what the agency wishes to do under what the administrative rules and such that we have. But, you know, we try to take input in a positive way, and I think by and large the division, you know, can always improve in certain areas, but we're falling between 80% and 90% for most of the agencies that are responding. To the question about IRMD and the 50%, that's a concern, as well as the Progress Board. And with IRMD, I read many of the comments in here, and some of them were around, you know, perhaps they should try to do one thing at a time, not so many things at one time. And many of the initiatives that they started over the last biennium, for example, the e-government program, business continuity planning program, the cybersecurity, the scenic project, they've had a lot on their plate. And so I think there's lots of room for improvement and communication with agencies, but there's a lot of change going on there. And so I think some of the comments in relation to IRMD are related to the change processes that they're trying to drive across state government. And sometimes not everyone gets included in the loop, and they feel like, you know, stuff is happening to them that they're not either able to impact or aware of until after the fact. IRMD has a number of advisory committees. One of the ones that's most significant, and that's the other way DAS gets feedback, is that all of our divisions typically have at least one, if not several, advisory groups that provide input to them on policy and changes. And for IRMD, they have the group that is the chief information officers from each of the agencies that they meet with regularly to discuss where is the state going in terms of technology. And that's a major conduit for input. Now, what we learned in the Scenic project is while IRMD is working with the chief information officers, when those information officers go back to their agencies, information is disseminated in various levels. They're not consistent necessarily in getting that information down through their staff members to perhaps the technician that's working on certain projects, because they all vary in how they choose and what they choose to communicate. So for the Scenic project, then usually it's the feedback to DAS is, you know, we haven't been working with the agency's people. For the Scenic project, we set up a technical group that also communicates, that's beyond the top manager in the agency. We have a subgroup that provides input to the Scenic project also, and we've used two communication channels there within agencies to try to get at some of those particular issues. But I think in the technology area, we're going to continue to need to work at the communication and input from the various levels from the agencies as we move forward with these changes. The Progress Board is another matter in that, of course, the Progress Board is focused on the Oregon benchmarks and then performance measures. And performance measures, as you know, are a challenge, have been for agencies, and the use of performance measures by the legislature has been changing over time also. So agencies, I think, feel like they get mixed messages about what they're supposed to do with performance measures. The Progress Board has three staff people, and those are the folks really that are trying to work with agencies and help them with that. And I think the agencies would like to see more assistance and consistency there. And some of the comments we got back on the Progress Board were around those particular issues about, you know, how do we get the help we need from you, and can the messages about how we're going to use these get more consistent? So again, I think that's an area that's under change, both from the legislative side and the administrative side of the exec branch, in terms of how we're using performance measures, and they get some of that feedback back to them. And it's a very small staff, is sure. The other aspect of it. We, you know, originally the Progress Board was supposed to be setting the vision for the future, working with the outside world in terms of an advisory board that provides input on more like the strategic vision for the state. Performance measures are a much more detailed process that they have to work on, and they've taken that on and they've done a reasonable job, I think, but there's room for improvement there too.
One of the things with regards to performance measures, though, is that hopefully, and this is, I think, probably one of the reasons why the Progress Board was drawn into this, is because one of the things that you want to do is how the performance measures relate to the vision for where we're going in the future.
And I think the Progress Board has done a pretty good job of linking those up.
Right.
But agencies have struggled with how do they measure and how do they link to those benchmarks, because some agencies don't have a natural link to those benchmarks, and then they're kind of uncertain as to
Sure. What
do I do, or you know, how should this be shown.
Lori, do you think that there's been much conflict from a standpoint of, because one of the things that, and what made me think about this is when you mentioned that the agencies feel like they get a mixed message. Is there a conflict with the performance measures as they're being presented either by the Progress Board or by the agency in terms of what they should be doing and what the statute says, or have some of the performance measures been developed around the statute? And I don't know if I'm
Mr. Chair, I don't think there's statutory conflicts with the performance measures. I think agencies struggle with how to best tell their story, what performance measure to use, and then how to have the data to be able to collect it and maintained over a period of time in order to support actually the performance measure. There's a lot of performance measures they could use, but they would have to, they may not have the data to do that, or they would have to develop data and invest and make some investments, and some agencies have done that. But I think the use of the performance measures by the legislature, the importance of them, has changed over time. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to, you know, keep up with that and figure out how to meet your needs, as well as their own management needs for information on performance within their particular agencies. In terms of our customer survey, we sent out about 6,000 surveys, and we got about 1,000 responses, so about a 20% or so response rate back to us. And, you know, we will keep working on that. We think that's an important tool, and we'll do follow-up in some of the areas. I plan to share your survey results with staff also. I have not done so yet, but I think it's important, as much feedback as we can get. It helps inform our processes and our managers about what people think. So that's an important aspect. Your next question was, does staff have a strategic plan? And if not, you know, when would DAS anticipate completion? The department had a number of strategic initiatives that I was talking to you about that started when Governor Kulongoski came in. Smart Buy was one of them. Scenic is another. But at this time, the department does not have a formally adopted strategic plan. And why is that? Well, in the last 3 years, the department has had 4 directors under 2 different governors. So some of the work has gotten started on a strategic plan, but it never got formally adopted and implemented within the agency. So planning for the strategic plan will be done during the interim here prior to the next 07-09 budget discussions with the legislature, but right at the moment we don't have a formally adopted plan.
Okay. I think that As we go, and we can talk about this a little bit later, but as we're looking at this, I think a lot of the initiatives that you've talked about, mm-hmm, are things that would fold into that sort of overall broad kind of strategic plan for the agency.
I think there's a lot of strategic initiatives going on, but they haven't been all tied together into one document. Needs to be shared across the agency so all employees are aware of what the plan is, what the goals are, which direction we're moving in. And, of course, agencies, you know, our external customers need that as well, but our internal staff need it also. So it is something that needs to happen for the department.
Mm-hmm.
I just think there's just been a lot of change in leadership, both in terms of the governor's office and the department, so that particular piece has not got done formally, in a formal way. One of your other questions was, what other services does DAS see as enterprise level? You know, basically, DAS, that's what DAS operates, is enterprise-wide systems. So our budget system, our payroll system, the smart buy that you saw, which is the purchasing piece, fleet management, the PEB board, that's the Public Employees Benefit Board, all of those things are enterprise-level kinds of services that we provide. We try to refine those in terms of how much are the agencies doing and using those, and how much do we have centrally that we're controlling. And I think that's really the trade-off. And that, for example, in the Scenic project, you know, we're now saying, okay, rather than having the data centers out in the agencies, we're going to have one consolidated data center. So we're moving in that direction, but all of these systems are enterprise-wide type of systems. That our infrastructure that supports state government. And that's basically largely what we operate. So those were the four questions I had from you.
Okay.
If you have other concerns that you want to raise, I'd be happy to address those too.
Okay. I think let me go back to enterprise for just a second. For example, payroll.
Uh-huh.
Almost all of the agencies rely on the DAS payroll function for their payroll to go out and
yes,
and all of that. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm just trying to clarify and make sure that I understand it correctly.
Yeah, that's a central payroll system, albeit it's rather old, and there are folks that, you know, believe we ought to be investing there, and that's something, you know, we look at how many investments can we make and what kinds of infrastructure. Because ultimately, the agencies have to pay for those investments through assessments.
Mm-hmm.
And while they want something on the one hand in terms of an improved system, and it may save money, we need to look at the business case, because ultimately, the agencies have to contribute to paying for it if it's implemented. So we need to make sure we have payback.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this segues, I think, what you're saying well into a couple of questions I had on the Smart Buy program, and I don't know if you are willing to address
those. I may not be the I'm not the expert
Duncan
on Smart
here,
Buy.
But I read through the slides after our hearing on Tuesday just to sort of, you know, have another look at the program. Mm-hmm. And I had some questions that came up, and I don't know if you'd be able to answer them. One of them applies to the point that you just raised about mm-hmm. assessing the agencies.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions I had is, are we doing a survey of every agency to see if, you know, they're getting a net benefit out of this program? In other words, we had more of an overview of the whole program, and I'm just
right.
curious if you've done a survey of each agency, you know, because they're being assessed, correct, for the Smart Buy program.
Yes, they are.
And to see if there's a net benefit, if they feel that they're getting a net benefit out of it, or, you know, they feel that their money is being spent wisely. I guess I'd be curious to see if you're planning to, if you haven't already done a survey of each agency.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I will try and answer here. Dugan's probably the better source, but in the overview part of this, yes, the agencies were assessed based on their usage of the system previously. And then I think when Dugan spoke on Tuesday, he said, you know, it was anticipated that they would continue to purchase the same kinds of things they were purchasing in the past, and so therefore the savings in those categories would accrue to them if there was a difference in one biennium over the next in terms of how much volume they were purchasing in certain areas. They might not realize the full savings, but the difference between that would be greater than what they were paying in the assessment. and the budget office for, in the department, the budget management office for the 05-07 biennium basically went in and, based on agency spend rates, reduced their budgets for 05-07 to capture those savings. So that was a conversation budget management had with the individual agencies. I couldn't tell you whether or not, specific comments we might have had back on that or not. But it was done at a gross level, not at a detailed level in terms of did we do an analysis agency by agency of all of their purchasing. We did it in a gross sense based on their usual practices versus what we projected to be savings in those categories, and with the assumption that they would continue to purchase in about the same pattern or have about the same usage as
okay.
products.
And a follow-up? Mr. Chair, thank you. That's helpful, although I guess I was thinking of just some type of survey, starting off that way and then doing a detailed analysis based on the findings, mm-hmm. preliminary findings. But another question I had was, and this is a follow-up to actually Representative Rosenbaum, who just came in, about the transfer of knowledge to our staff. Because looking at the numbers in here, are we going to, when the contract's up, are we going to do an assessment of if, investing that money and hiring a couple of key people mm-hmm. to get the same, realize the same type of savings, or are we going to, doing some type of analysis and audit, which I saw that step four includes an audit, but I don't know if that's already been done or that's planned for, but, between the audit results and then looking at the transfer of knowledge, if hiring, continually hiring a contractor is necessarily the way to go.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfeld, I think that Dugan spoke a little bit to that when he was here on Tuesday, in that we are in the process, of course, as the staff work through with this particular contractor these changes, they have picked up some of that knowledge. Now, clearly they don't have the level of expertise that the contractor who focuses on that as a business does. And I think the reality is that as these contracts are in place and the projected savings are there, we will realize those savings over the period of the contract. When the contract comes up from renewal, we'll have to assess whether or not we think our staff can handle that renewal or whether we'll need some outside help to do that. And, of course, we'll look at a business case as to whether or not what we think the trade-offs are in terms of investing using our staff or using an outside contractor again. We always try to look at the business case for it so that we don't spend money that we don't realize in returns from investing in consultants to help the project move forward. So I think that at the time that those contracts renew, that's what we'll be faced with making that decision.
Okay. And one final question, thank you, is, and I don't think Dugan addressed this, but I was out of the room for part of his testimony, is I'd be interested, since there's a list of the other states, and actually I saw the city of Portland was on there, so that was pretty mm-hmm. interesting. I'll probably be talking to the city, but I'm just curious, and I don't know if you can answer this. If not, maybe Dugan can, is what product are we receiving that's different from what the other states? In other words, is this something that's cookie cutter that each state, it's sort of on a formulaic basis, or is it something tailored specifically to the state of Oregon? And I was just curious, what kind of individual type of service that we're receiving through this contractor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, when Dugan spoke about this, and I've heard him speak about this often, Oregon researched what other states had done before we drafted RFP to find out what worked and what didn't, and where you got the best leverage. So I think the RFP that we went out with was specific to Oregon in terms of how we wanted this to work. And in terms of, if you're looking at, if the question is more around, is it cookie cutter, which products to look at, which make the most sense, mm-hmm. that I can't answer. If the categories they looked at for Oregon are, pretty routinely the ones that you'd look at in other states or not. So Dugan probably would need to get back to you on that, and I can have him do that.
Great. Thank you.
But the RFP was tailored specifically based on experience other folks had had and our best thinking about our culture and what would work for us.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify on that, sure. Mr. Chair, I think it's your point about the RFP is well taken, but it's more the latter part that you discussed about
products
and is this, sort of standardized specifications that are using in other states. So sort of what are we getting for the money that we're investing in? having worked as a consultant to government agencies before, I know that sometimes that does happen. So,
yeah.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh.
Thank you,
I'll have
Chair, for indulging me on that.
Okay.
Well, one of the, I would point out also that one of the things that Dugan did talk about as well was that, for example, I think the states that we had looked at, Florida, Delaware, and Virginia, had actually gone to a payment to the consultant based on a percentage of savings.
Mm-hmm.
And he corrected me because I had made a comment in an earlier audits meeting about 50% leverage to in reaction to one of Representative Rosenbaum's questions, and he corrected me on that, and that this was a specific dollar amount contract,
right,
as opposed to a contract based on savings, and he preferred to do it that way, and it sounds like our administration preferred to do it that way because it gave us more of a defined outcome from a standpoint of the product, or a defined payment as
yeah.
far as what the and what the outcome to expect. But kind of following up on that for a second, one of the things, and I know that you guys probably absolutely hate this, but my crack staff. And I can't find it. My crack staff did some research as far as comments that had been made to the press and that sort of thing. And one of the things, and granted, Lori, you can't necessarily be held accountable for something that that a predecessor says to the press. However, the comment was made
be responsible
that through this that through the Smart Buy program there should be approximately up to about a 20% savings, and that the state on an annual basis spends about $500 million a year in product services and other goods that would be affected or potentially be affected by this. Well, a 20% savings would be $100 million. And if in fact we do, and the Marina report did show that there's been auditable and
right.
savings in the realm of about over a 6 month period of about a little over $5 million,
right.
which means that for that 6 month period would have only meant that we spent Now, there's a lot of ifs here, but if that represents a 20% savings, then that means that there had only been about $25 million spent, which wouldn't quite, in a six-month period, wouldn't quite jive with spending $500 million in a six-month period. So I'm just, and I'm not trying to, but I'm just wondering if that was, was the expectation sort of over-aggressive, or are we figuring out that there's things that we need to do to tweak it so that we can realize those kind of savings? Or, because 20% really is, that's a big number.
Mr. Chair, not knowing exactly what numbers they were basing that on, I'm probably not in a position really to defend that one way or another, or critique it. Dugan had that, I don't have the handout with me, I don't think, but he had that one pager that showed you when the contractor came in, they sort of assessed the range of potential savings that might occur based on when they selected the categories
right.
that they were going to focus on. And I think basically that was around it was 10 to 18 or something range, if I'm recalling correctly.
Right, right.
And that over the life of these contracts, they're figuring that we will save about $50 million.
Yes.
So the statement you're referring to, I don't know. I can't respond necessarily because I don't know what that was what numbers that was based on.
That's why I say sort of in fairness to you, but this was a press, and I wish I could find the article right now. I thought I had it here, and I thought I. Sure, I had it
but,
here, but
you know, certainly if there was something to the effect that we would make 20% savings, I can certainly have Dugan respond to that to say what were we thinking, and he may have more background on that than I do.
And like I said, this was a comment that was made, and if I can find it while we're here, I will certainly. Maybe this is it. I thought I had it right here,
But I think we're looking at, you know, $50 million over the life of these particular contracts that have been worked on. What percentage that is, I don't know, because I'd have to go. We'd have to go look at the base.
Sure, sure.
And we can get back to you on that if you'd like that information.
Okay. I think that would be helpful because and I think this is the handout that you're referring
right.
to.
Right. There's a page in there that shows.
Given us. And on colleagues on pages 11, 12, and 13 is where, and particularly on 11, on page 11 is where I think Lori is referring to. And yes, it does show that over the and the length of the contract with the company again is.
Well, those contracts vary because there's multiple different contracts there that you look. Oh, the contract with Silver Oaks.
Yeah,
that's for this biennium.
That's just for this biennium.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the length of those contracts that you're going to get savings over those, I couldn't tell you the specific contract length for each one of those.
Sure. And so it's going to depend. So, for example, on office supplies, the contract dealing with that, and over the life of that
right.
contract, he's the guest. You know, I'll say guesstimate is about almost $14 million.
Right.
And so okay. Well, that's that starts making sense. But I think that, you know, one of the things, of course, that we always want to be careful of is setting higher.
I agree with
and
you.
And of course, the press is very very helpful in this. Is when we set higher levels of expectation in what we can deliver, and then of course, and you know, it gives people ammunition to
right.
sort of
and
criticize
so
us.
Right. And instead of celebrating your success, you're trying to defend why you didn't achieve that level.
Right.
And it's,
right. Exactly.
Exactly. You put yourself in a box you'd rather not be in.
Exactly. Yes. That's very correct. Okay. Representative Brown or Representative Rosenbaum, do you have any questions for Lori? The questions that you had dealt with. One of the issues that was in here that I had written down, and one of the things that I kind of noticed about the responses, and Lori, I don't know if you noticed also or not, there seem to be some inconsistencies in responses from a standpoint of which services agencies feel are mandatory that they go to the department for and which services they can go sort of to the open market for. Did you get that when you read through this? Did you get that same sense at all? And
Mr. Chair, yes, and I noticed that, and the fact that some of the things they said that were assessment and some of them that they thought were price per unit of service are not correct either. And I think what it led me to understand is that agencies don't necessarily completely understand how they're being charged, and that they don't understand exactly which services are mandatory and which they can go to the open market for. So I did pick that up from the results in there, and that's something we'll talk about internally. One thing I would note is that we meet, the department meets, twice a month with the agency heads, I do, and once a month with the large agency heads, and then once a month with small agency heads. And we basically, in the last budget cycle, in the interim, spent some time with both groups talking about how DASA's charges are configured, what they pay for, which are assessments, and which are fee-for-service. But again, you know, that's an agency head conversation. I'm not sure who responded to your survey, whether it was agency heads or folks, administrative services folks, or who they were, because sometimes that understanding doesn't necessarily get translated down. But yes, there was confusion in some of those areas. I noted that.
Yeah. Okay. I was wondering if that is more of a training issue or a communication issue.
I think it's a communication issue,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
I can tell you that the surveys that we sent out were sent to the agency heads. Now, whether the agency head assigned it to somebody else to respond,
uh-huh.
or they sat down and crafted the responses themselves, I don't know, and I couldn't control that.
Yeah, and I don't know either. So, but I do think it's a communication issue for the department. We'd clearly like people to understand, you know, what they're buying and how it's charged to them or not, and where they have latitude or not.
Right. So. Okay. When you do your the survey that you've that you do
and
yes. I don't remember because you did show me the questions and I've got a copy of them. But do you see those same kinds of inconsistencies?
You know, we have an open comment question at the end of it, and so yes, we get an awful lot of kind of comments about things that would be of concern in terms of knowing when folks are saying those things that they're not understanding how or what they have available to them or how to use the systems.
Mm-hmm.
So we do get that. It varies agency from agency because, like all agencies, folks have turnover in staff. So someone before them may, may have been there many years and learned, you know, how it works, and you may have new people coming in that don't quite fully understand that, and with as large of state government as we have, getting everyone up to speed on all that stuff as turnover occurs is a challenge. So we constantly try to do that. And the user groups that we have for each of the divisions, I think, are probably the better way to do that, because those are the people that are actually interfacing with our staff on a regular basis, and that's the folks that need to interact and figure out, help agencies figure out how to use the systems, get their questions answered.
Okay. One of the notes that I had made to myself was that IRMD needs to be uplifted and helping the agencies, I guess, understand the enterprise level services. And how they can adjust locally to meet some of their own needs.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I get, you know, I don't know how much of this is communication and how much of it is just, you know, understanding and that sort of thing. But
mm-hmm.
but some of the as we talked about a little earlier, some of the survey responses were not real kind to IRMD. And I do know from being on the joint interim Information Management Technology Committee that that IRMD has definitely had their plate full.
Yeah.
They've been, there's a lot of things that they've been doing, and I think part of what they're part of what they've been doing is trying to sort of make up for lost time. I guess it's about the only way that I can really think to put it, colleagues, is that they're really trying to make up for lost time because there's a lot of things that weren't done previously in a decentralized kind of environment. That when you try to then bring it back into a centralized environment, it does not make it very easy.
Yeah.
To accomplish, and particularly in the IT world, because one of the things that I learned in the years that I in the 3 years that I've worked in IT is that first of all, everyone suffers very much from NIH syndrome, not invented here.
Mm-hmm.
So if they didn't think of it, it really can't be a very good idea. And so then you really have to go in and sell them on the idea. The other thing is that if they were folks that were brought in under a decentralized kind of environment where they could make their own choices about
yeah.
what PCs to use, what servers to use, what kind of software to run, whether what kind of security program to run, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And now all of a sudden, via the CIO Council, they're sort of being brought in, and now they're told, well, we're going to centralize everything. We're putting everything under kind of an enterprise umbrella, and that becomes a very difficult transition to make. And whether you work for an agency like DHS, which is a huge agency, or an agency like the Health Licensing Office, which is a relatively small agency, the transition is not necessarily any easier. And so I think that's one of the things that I was trying to decide whether some of the comments were
were, I mean, they were unkind, but whether they were, you know, sort of what they were based in, and not necessarily trying to read between the lines, but I think that, but that's the one thing that you know, hopefully can happen, is that IRMD can kind of get a little uplift.
And, you know, Mr. Chair, I would say, to give credit to the CIO group, is that you're right. They have been able to make a lot of independent decisions, and now they're being asked to participate and make group decisions in a collaborative way. So it's a much different skill set, and the choices that you make in that way are not going to specifically meet every little thing that each agency wants. And so they have to give up something for the good of the order, so to speak, in order to move the collective body ahead as an enterprise. So there's been a lot of growth going on, I think, in that group, and we appreciate the efforts that have been made there, but it hasn't been without a lot of pain.
Yes, and probably a lot of pushback.
Yes.
One of the questions kind of coming back to that with regards to assessments and kind of following up a little bit on what Representative Dingfelder was asking about, with regards to the consolidated data center, if an agency is not participating in that at this point because they've, just because it's right now it's the Big 12, sounds like a sports conference,
uh-huh. Yeah.
The Big 12. But anyway, because it's the Big 12, they're not. But agencies that are not participating yet are not being assessed for the data center yet. Correct?
That's true.
Oh, okay. But they are being assessed for other services that IRMD is providing.
Yes, for them. That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I know that that early in the session. One of the first times that you appeared before us, we talked about the assessments and how they're configured and mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And then, like for example, with the Smart Buy program, when the decision was made to go to that, so now there's an assessment, and there's not really a lot of choice. You know, I'm an agency head; I haven't been given really any choice. I have to participate in this because I'm told to, but now there's going to be a reduction in my budget as far as an assessment is concerned. Is there a better way that we could look at the funding model for the Department of Administrative Services, or is this about as good as it gets? And I know that's a really broad and really open question.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I think I had spoke to some folks, perhaps not this committee, but, you know, in the past, DAS was funded, had general fund that covered some of these functions, so agencies were not assessed for them. But as the budget changes have occurred over time, the decision was made to assess everyone, because that way other fund and federal fund agencies paid for that infrastructure as well as the general fund. So it reduced the amount of general fund supporting the department and spread those costs over all the funding streams for the state. So I think that was a conscious decision to try to make it more equitable. And I think, you know, the issue always is if you do a fee-for-service, people feel like, you know, they get a product they're buying, they get something in return for the fee. An assessment in areas where it's hard to identify the unit that you're buying or purchasing, those assessment charges are the ones I think that agencies struggle more with, because that's typically based on FTE or partial FTE and partially size of budget or some combination. But I think, you know, that is where we are today in terms of how the agency is funded. I think that's been arrived at over time, kind of struggling back and forth. For the most part, if we can identify a unit cost and can do a fee-for-service, that's a better mechanism for us than assessments, because assessments are always harder to explain and agencies struggle some. The purchasing piece was a e-board discussion about how to move forward with Smart Buy and how to pay for it. clearly we could have gotten a general fund appropriation for the contractor and then not gone the assessment route across the agencies, but most of the time general fund dollars are so scarce that we want to minimize those as much as possible. Agencies basically, I think the struggle they sometimes have is understanding, okay, I'm going to get a charge here, but I'm going to get something back over here. And it's intuitive, but it's also hard to see explicitly, I guess. It's more in the overall scheme of their budget, and so they're concerned about it. They're concerned about spending money that they hadn't initially planned for, realizing that downstream they will get money back that should cover that, but they got to pay for it up front and get the money back on the back end. And I think that's where they get nervous sometimes. Depends on how tight their budget is.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and if they're getting, if the savings are actually coming back to them, which
yeah.
I guess if it's not money out of their budget, then I guess, in other words, if something used to cost $10 and now they're buying it for $8,
yeah.
They wrote a check for $8 instead of $10, so I guess they retained the...
And the difference got taken out of their budget this time when the governor configured the 507 budget from the smart buy, so that money didn't get left there. For 0305, it was more, we didn't take money out. We basically said the cost that you're going to pay for the contractor and getting the one-time things in place will be offset by the savings, and it should be budget neutral.
Right.
That was the philosophy. And some agencies probably came out ahead. Some of them probably came out even, and some of them probably came out a little bit under, depending upon how their purchasing actually went.
Right. And then, but then for the 0507 governor's recommended budget, it was...
decreased.
We're decreasing your budget because
right.
you should have these savings
yes.
and that sort of thing. And
so no, they didn't get a lot of choice.
And that's probably the thing that they object to the most, huh? Okay. Talking a little bit about the performance measures for the agencies. As we're going through that this session, are you seeing that as being valuable for the agencies so that it really helps them in terms of setting a clearer vision of what their mission is, the things that they need to be paying attention to, and also from your perspective, I mean, when you know. From the side, moving away from the service side for a second and over to the regulatory side, do you find that those are helpful in terms of how, when in your interactions with the agencies from a standpoint of their understanding of what it is that they need to be doing?
Mr. Chair, I think, the performance measures are still in the evolutionary phase. This budget cycle, Ways and Means has focused, the processes have focused pretty extensively on that up front. So they're getting a lot more attention and a lot more discussion with the Ways and Means committees about performance measures.
Mm-hmm.
I will give the example of the last budget. You know, we spent a lot more time this time on performance measures than what I've seen in the past and got some good feedback from committee members about what they thought was important. We also ourselves are making suggestions about how to refine probably at least a third of ours for next time around. So I think that we're not in the phase of a mature performance measurement system. I think we're still learning.
Mm-hmm.
And the dialogue with the legislature so that it meets their needs too is an important part of that.
Right.
I can't say to you that I think we're at the point where, you know, that in all instances, we have some performance measures which are very good that tell us where we are with programs and can be used pretty reliably. We have others that need some work. So that's just specific from the DAS budget, and I think you would find that kind of across the board in agencies as we evolve that system to meet your needs and our needs. I don't, in terms of working with the agencies, we have not focused necessarily on performance measures for purposes of the DAS director working with those agencies other than through the progress board work. because most of them are not measuring, right now anyway, financial outputs and that sort of things.
Right. Okay. Representative Rosenbaum, do you have any questions?
I do not have any.
I've just sort of been, you know, firing away here, and I want to make sure that I give you and Representative Dingfelder the opportunity to...
Just being edified by your train of thought.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Okay. For right now, I think that's all.
Thank you very much.
Lori, thank you very much, and again, I apologize on Tuesday.
Worked out fine.
But hey, gave you the opportunity to just listen to a lively discussion, right? Okay, what I would like to do, we've got some information here relative to the collection sorts of issues that came up, and you'll remember that this was an issue that had come up a couple of weeks ago, I guess, and we had a hearing on, and I'd like to ask John if he'd like to come back up. I know that also we've got in front of us a response from Jim Markey, and he's represented today by Matt, in some of the comments that were made by the department relative to credits and collections and agency collections and how that's going, and liquidated and delinquent debt and accounts. And then also I was informed this morning that one of the other things that's occurring is that the department and with John and also the Department of Justice the Marquis are going to be kind of sitting down together, getting everybody together in the same room, which is, you know, really probably a pretty good idea, to kind of go over what some of the issues are and how we can move this along, because as we've pointed out here, and we pointed out a couple of weeks ago, there's a large amount of outstanding debt, and there's been concern about what steps the agencies and then the Department of Revenue and then the Justice Department and then kind of going back and forth is how these debts are being collected or in many cases being written off. And one of the things that we would like to do is get the amount of money that is owed to the state back down. So what I wanted to do is first ask John. John, you've prepared a couple of documents for us here, and I just want to give you an opportunity to kind of go over those a little bit. Not too long, though, because we are on a limited amount of time here, and I want to make sure that I get the opportunity to hear from Matt as well as the Department of Justice.
Okay. So for the record, Representative Crone, members of the committee, my name is John DeFrannan with the State Controller's Office, and I don't intend to read from the testimony. I'll kind of let you do that. And instead, I'd like to jump right over to the graphics. Okay. And then kind of tie those into some of the questions and kind of deal with it that way.
Sure, that'd be great.
First, to address the amount of the debt, there's approximately $1.5 billion in debt, and as the graphic there on slide 2 shows, that's the distribution of that debt to all the state agencies. We kind of prioritize that, so you can see that 29.3% is with Judicial, 28.9% is with the Department of Revenue, 23.2% is with the Department of Justice, and on down. As that indicates, roughly just over 80% of the debt lies with three agencies, and actually you can take that next statistic to 98% of the debt is with 9 state agencies. So the debt is fairly highly concentrated. If we get things that work with these agencies, we can do greater good, faster, more economical, and so forth. The next slide, or the next page in slide 3, shows the distribution of accounts and the account turnover. Over the last 5 years, and this is since House Bill 1999's House Bill 3509, where we've had the opportunity to use the liquid and delinquent accounts report from Legislative Fiscal Office, we compile this data from that report to see how is the debt moving through the pipeline. I remember then-Representative Winters talking about we need to keep this debt moving. And so this is one of the graphics we use to show how that debt is moving through the pipeline. Obviously, in the early days, there's only about $50 million out to the private collection firms, as you see in that graphic. And through the use of the statewide collection contract, we've almost have $400 million out with the private collection firms. In fact, if you look at the actual amount of debt that was distributed out there, they started with approximately $300 million last year, and were given another additional about $180 million through the year. So at some point in time, they had as much as $480 million out with the private collection firms for that time. Similarly, around $200 million with the other agency account units of the Department of Revenue, and again, about another $100 million goes through there, so they're right around $200, $300 million. So that approximates 40% of the state's debt is going through the other agency account unit and private collection firms based on last year's data. The following slide shows
I want to make sure I heard you correctly. So there's about $400 million out currently, and at any time through the year there may have been as much as $480 million out.
Yes.
And that's about 40%. But when I do the math, $1.5 billion, 40% of $1.5 billion would be about $675 million. Right around $675, $680. So it's a little short of 40%. Am I misunderstanding something here?
The 40% I talked about is the amount of debt at the other agency account unit and private collection firms.
Oh, okay. Okay, I missed it.
So it's out of the hands of the state agencies.
Okay. Got it. Thank you.
The following slide shows where the debt has been collected over that same five-year period. And as you see, as a cumulative approach, the amount of debt collected by state agencies amounts to just over $1 billion.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dingfelder?
So what percentage of that, so the $1 billion represents what percentage of the debt that we're actually collecting? In other words, you're saying we've collected over $1 billion cumulatively. What percentage is that?
On a year-to-year basis, the average collection by state agencies runs about 19 to 20%.
Can you say that again? I want to make sure I understood you correctly.
On a year-to-year basis, approximately 19 to 20% is collected by state agencies. Approximately 7 to 8% is collected by the other agency units. Other agency account unit, the Department of Revenue, and approximately 2 to 2.5% is collected by private collection firms.
So, in any given year over year, we're only collecting about 30% of debt. Is what I'm
in that ballpark. Now, you have to recall that part of this debt keeps moving on.
Over.
So, you have fresh debt and you have existing debt. So, that's why I was careful in the way I responded to the question.
Okay, and that goes back to bringing up another rather touchy subject, and that is the aging of the accounts. Do we have an accurate way of aging of these accounts?
The next slide.
Okay.
Thank you for the segue, Representative.
Good. Before you go on, though,
sure.
Representative Brown, did you have a question or comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe it's going to be answered anyway. The just a little over $1 billion collected, that's bad debt. And then how do you define what's bad debt?
I try not to use the term bad debt because it creates all types of accounting questions and so on and so forth. So what we call it is liquidated and delinquent accounts. And the definition for that, which I kind of talked to a little bit in the context, in the state we receive an accounts receivable. There has been some event that creates a claim, whether that's been the sales of goods or services, whether it's a civil penalty, whether it's the payment of your taxes. Some type of event has created a claim. Because we are a government entity, we're prescribed to follow the due process clause of the U.S. and Oregon constitutions. That means we have to go through some type of process to allow the person to contest either the liability or the amount. So that's the liquidation process. Once it's liquidated and it's delinquent, that's where we really start placing our focus on collections And that's the purpose of this report, is to identify what is the liquid and delinquent debts and what are we doing with them. And answer your question?
I'm not sure. I feel like I just drank out of the water, out of the fire hose.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Brown, let me walk through this a little bit further, and maybe we'll kind of answer
okay.
that if we work
All
through
right.
it.
All right.
So to kind of just skip back to the questions about how the debt is used in reporting to the credit bureaus, on attachment one, which is right after page 3, I show an example purchase order agreement. That's the purchase order agreement that we tie to the statewide collection contract, and we give the opportunity for every state agency to express their desire to have their debt reported to the credit bureau. Skipping back to the previous page, we have a chart there that shows what percentage of the agencies exercise that authority. So, for instance, disclosure to credit bureau, it says judicial request disclosure, revenue no disclosure, justice no disclosure. The Student Assistance Commission, as you know, it has relinquished its debt back to the Federal Department of Education.
Right.
Employment no disclosure, DCBS request disclosure, OUS, most of the universities request disclosure, ODOT, so forth, Department of Transportation. So, this is kind of why I highlight this to show what I put there at the bottom. When I talk about the total for the agencies, that's 98.6% of the total debt, referring back to the pie chart I showed you before.
Yeah.
If we look at it in terms of the total debt, 50% of the agencies disclose, but only 36% of the debt is disclosed. And this is why I'm trying to highlight the fact that we try to concentrate on the dollars, because if we were to tell you 50% of the agencies do that, well, that's a true statement. But that 50% only relates to 36% of the debt. So we believe it's better to talk about the percent of the debt, because that's where the real exposure is. That's what we're trying to collect.
John, why would revenue and justice and DHS not want to have disclosure?
In the text where I talk about this briefly, Chair Cromwell, there are some steps that they need to follow through to make sure the debt is liquidated. Once it gets into a purely liquidated form, that would be the thing that they'd have to decide at what point that could be declared. In a recent public records request by the Statesman to collect some information on debtor information, that the Department of Justice found that, for instance, Student Assistance Commission, they'd like to see the actual debtor information. It would have been a violation of federal law to release that information. Consequently, there could be problems if they were to try to use that information as a credit bureau reporting, because it would amount to disclosure. So those are the particular things that the agencies have to look at, what their disclosure laws are, and does this create any types of headaches for them.
But they still can. But they still can age the accounts.
Correct. And let's just go right to that question. On that same graphic, just to kind of keep things together, the aging reports. This was the information. Again, we've surveyed the agencies to collect this information. We hadn't done this for a while, and we were happy to learn that the majority of the agencies now do have better aging report systems than we've had previously.
They all go out and buy QuickBooks.
I don't think they had that much money to spend.
So they went to the SFMS, huh? Well, that's, you know, that is a that really is a big. Pardon?
Mr. Chair, I was just questioning whether you were going to be paying the pig. Your last comment.
Oh, probably.
Statewide financial management system, I believe.
The SFMS, the statewide financial management system. I guess I do owe the
$5. I think that's a lot.
Oh, I'm probably up to that. I'm probably up to that at least. Yes. Okay. But you're finding then that now most, at least of these 9 agencies, they are now able to age their debt. And judicial is going to be able to as of this month.
Chair Crummell, that's what we understand. I relate that back to House Bill 3509. That was one of the scrutinies that that brought about better looking at the data. And so, again, I think that was one of the positives, that we really have a better handle than, in fact, some of the other states were hearing very similar types of stories.
I can wait until you're done.
Do you think then that by being able to AC accounts, number one, will we be a little quicker in terms of, here's an account, it's aged the statutory mandate of 90 days. We're sending it over to revenue. It's been there now. It's aged there now, 90 days. We're sending it out to a private collection agency. So we know that, you know, as opposed to a private collection agency getting a debt that was, we think it's 180 days, but it could be 840 days, which is what, 3.5 years or something. So it's to potentially increase the, because we all know, anybody that's been in business knows and understands, when you have money that's owed to you and it's on an aged account, the longer that you go without getting payment, the greater the chance is that you're not going to get paid. I mean, that's just, that has been proven time and time again, and I'm sure Representative Brown could probably tell us about that, although when you go buy tires, you pay for them.
Chair Carmel, yes, and in fact, I like the idea about the buying the tires, and I'll get back to that here in a minute. But certainly it would be, the perfect situation would be we'd send out the bill and we'd receive payment. Again, because we are a government, we have to follow the due process clause. We use a variety of other instruments to try and secure that debt. On page 7 of the Legislative Fiscal Office report, and I don't know if you have that with you today, but
I didn't bring it.
In the OA, at the bottom of my thing, I give you a link to all this information so you can take a look. But on page 7, for instance, we have consensual security interests on 554 accounts for $9.5 million. We've got court order judgments of $6.7 million. We have litigation and bankruptcy, 10,000 accounts for $67 million. So there is a group of accounts that, as you say, will flow through pretty normally, or they could be interrupted by occasional payments, which resets those 90 and 100, 365-day limits. But there are some accounts that are going to end up in some turmoil. They get into hospitalized debtors, they get into prison debtors, and all those types of things. And again, that's about $115 million in that list of bumps in the road of getting it turned over to either the Department of Revenue, other agency accounting unit, or a private collection firm. But that certainly would be the goal, is that these types of systems allow them to do this automatically. I know that there's been some work with Judicial and the Department of Revenue's other agency account unit and the Department of Revenue to put some automatic turnovers in their system so that when it reaches a certain thing, the system tells them it's time. So that obviously creates a more perfect system, and that work is being done.
Okay.
I don't want to skip over here, so I'll go what was number 2, provide a copy of the collection contract amendments to the stakeholders. And we have provided that information out, and as you indicated, there's some work to get together again. We had a meeting about 2 or 3 weeks ago and discussed the amendment. We've had, in fact, we were really very happy with the amount of responses received from state agencies and the private collection firms, and the Marquis offered us some information as well. So we've gone through and have kind of tried to get all the best pieces together, and trying to, by the end of this week, as I indicate, have the second amendment available to take a look at.
Okay.
What can the committee do to motivate state agencies or state debtors? Attachment 2, which is right behind the purchase order agreement. And here's where I get to talk about the tires. Electronic funds transfer, House Bill 2030. Now, this is actually a payment process. This is an outbound process, not an inbound process. But any types of electronic processes, we're highly supportive of. The e-commerce initiative that DAS has sponsored the last 2 or 3 years, we did $10 million worth of online transactions last year. One other little highlight to that, and this is what we found across the U.S., and in fact we're working with the National Association of State Auditors, Controllers, and Treasurers, who's trying to get some special rates for governments because of the less amount of fraud and chargebacks and so on and so forth that occur through the credit card programs when working with state governments. So we believe we should get a better rate because we're lower risk. We had zero chargebacks in that $10 million in credit cards, which is a very good low-risk thing. So those are some of the things that we see. Plus, because of the state treasurer's contract with the provider for banking services, we actually receive next day delivery on those funds. So if we process it at 5 p.m. today, it will be in our treasury at 12:01 tomorrow morning. And that's a benefit we have not heard from any other state in their e-commerce projects. Mostly it's 2 to 3 days. So those are some things we'd like to see. Again, if we get the money up front, which is what I actually talked to about here in the next piece, if we're getting it at the point of sale, if we can get a credit card, if we can get a good check, and we're talking about some ways maybe we can find out if the checks are good before we get them, there's guaranteed funds. The Check 21 initiative of the...
Do you use debit cards?
The state treasury has a limitation on debit cards at this point unless they contain the Visa logo. But that's certainly an area. ACH and debit cards are an area that we're looking into, and we have a number of meetings already scheduled with the state treasury to talk about other types of payment systems.
Okay. Representative Dingfelder had a couple of questions, and before we get too much further, I'd like to make sure we get back to those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was in regards to the question I asked about the percentage, which is unfortunately somewhat disturbing. I know that we're doing better now than we had in the past. However, how do we rate to other states as far as the percentage, and are we more aggressive, less aggressive on the average, you know, aggressive as far as going after these delinquent accounts?
Chair Crummell, Representative Dingfelder, the answer is yes. We are more aggressive and we are less aggressive. We monitor the audits of other state agencies, or excuse me, of other state entities, and we also have periodic contacts with other states and ask them how they're doing. I talked with one of the people in the Controller's Office of the State of California last March, and we were discussing some of the things that were going on, and they said, yeah, we just wrote off $1.5 billion in debt. And I thought, wow, that's our total liquid and delinquent account structure. And they've written that off. And you have to remember them as a factor of 10. So anything that they do is about a factor of 10. So they're doing, you know, $30 billion and more in total revenues. And we're lucky if we can hit the $15 billion mark. So when we looked at their write-offs, we said, you know, if we're doing less than $70 million, you know, $1.5 billion, less than $700 million, we're doing like $70 million. That doesn't sound too bad when we're compared to California. The problem in those types of analysis, and I did a chart for this for the Association of Government Accountants a few years ago, is that we're a two-legged stool, and we're really only a one-legged stool because our property taxes aren't state government resources. Those are local districts. So when we compare to other states like California who has sales tax, property tax, and income tax, it becomes kind of a disjointed. However, we still do that. We try to see what our measurements. When we look at California, when we look at Idaho, Utah, California, Oregon, Washington, and Nevada, we fall about to the middle, or maybe just one step to the right of the middle, a little bit toward the high side. We called the state of Idaho, who has incredible accounts receivable numbers, and again, we're looking at it from an accounts receivable standpoint because others don't track their data the way we do. They're very low, and we're trying to find out what it is they do, and they can't tell us. So on the other side is the state of Nevada, and when I did a presentation to the National Association of State Auditors, Controllers, and Treasurers about 3 years ago, they said, wow, we don't want to be out here. And they've done a lot of work to try and improve their receivables, and we've been in contact with them with some ideas. They're using private collection firms now. So,
which state is that again?
That's the state of Nevada. So we try to do those comparisons. In fact, at one point, we even compared ourselves to Nike, Microsoft, Intel, and Gannett News Services. And we felt pretty favorable, of course, on the right-hand side in that group as well in terms of our accounts receivable to total revenue.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, you're good.
No, I'm just cogitating here.
If you'd like some of that data, I'd be happy to furnish that and some historical data we've done in the past.
That would be helpful.
That'd be good. John, let me have you kind of wrap up in about a minute or less, because I want to make sure that we get Department of Justice and Matt up here as well.
Okay. Just to turn back to Attachment 2 real quick, House Bill 2132 is where we try to define reasonable time as a period less than 12 months.
Okay.
We'd like that as to incentivize collections. Our concern is that maybe the private collection firms would work a little faster and harder if they knew they only had it for a shorter period of time. Right now, there is no competition. They can let it sit there, and we think we need something to get it a little bit more motivation there. Senate Bill 37 is a successor liability. Again, it allows the employment to go after entities that are trying to kind of churn their debt and not take care of their taxes.
Right.
Senate Bill 480 is the Department of Revenue bill that helps tax compliance, collects withholding. There's a legislative concept, 3545, which is a statewide lien registry. We think it has a number of positive benefits. It would allow statewide liens. It would allow the ability to put this out on the Internet so that everybody could check and see if anybody had statewide liens. So it has a number of benefits. There was a number of states have looked at what they call cyber shame, where they put your name out if you haven't paid your bills or something. And right after that started a couple years ago, there was the term cyber defame. And some of the attorneys started capturing the opportunity that if you put out something wrong and it was a defamation, there was some risk there. So I get real nervous about some of those types of things.
Yeah, I'm not sure I could.
So another concept that we began work on is a lottery offset. We don't know that there's any statutory stuff yet to do on that, but we just began some of the discussions. Child support currently has that ability to offset those lottery things, lottery dollars, and we're looking for a way that doesn't bludgeon lottery, make it a nice economical process. Occupational suspension license, and we have another concept that we're looking at that would augment the debt cost recovery. There's some problems in using the current debt cost recovery that's allowed to us under 293-231-12 in the judgment process. So we're looking at a way maybe to beef that up to make that more effective.
Okay.
I think I conclude with those remarks. Any questions?
Thank you, John. Are there any other questions? Great. Thank you. Matt, let me have you come on up. And actually, can you and Ronell come up together? I guess I actually could have had you all three up together, since you're going to eventually wind up in the same room together. Of course, I won't be there. And
okay.
So, Matt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Markey representing the Oregon Collectors Association today. And I'd first just like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee in taking the time and effort to work on this issue. It is an important issue to the state, and we're glad to see it moving forward. We're becoming more confident that we are going to be able to come to some sort of an agreement between the small claims and garnishment issue. You've seen DAS's proposal, and you've seen our comments on that. I spoke with Department of Justice this morning and Ronell, and she's assured us that we're all going to sit down together in the same room and negotiate a little bit and work through these issues. And I know that seems kind of obvious, but it hasn't happened at this point, so we're looking forward to that taking place. Just on the concepts that Mr. Dufresne laid forth, the last one on your list dealing with the debt recovery stuff, that's the first time I've heard of this particular problem, and I think if we can work through that, I think that would be a good thing. This is a program, or this particular cost recovery is a powerful tool, I think, not only for collection agencies, but also for the state of Oregon in general before the account ever gets to a collection agency. I'm sure that if it needs a legislative fix, that there's a vehicle here in this process that we can find to do so. I was also, it was nice to hear that aging of accounts is something that can start taking place. Mr. Chair, you mentioned it'd be nice to know when accounts were being turned over to the private collection agencies and mentioned 180 days. I just wanted to remind you that Department of Revenue in the last hearing said that their average assignment was after 1.6 years. So if we could get to 180 days, I would love that. But just thinking
I forgot.
Of yeah. Just thinking of the aging, if state agencies are willing and able to do this now, it might be something to look at putting into the legislative fiscal report so we can start tracking on the aging of these accounts and seeing how, if they're growing older, or if we're, what types of systems we're looking at there. Again, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to thank you and the committee for the time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions for Matt? Thank you. Ronell.
Chair Cromwell, representatives, I'm Ronell Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office, and as Chair Cromwell has informed you, it is true that the Department of Justice is committed to joining the discussion. Staff has been doing a great job of gathering comments, and I think we're at the point where we can all sit down and start to negotiate out some actual language. I understand from the Assistant Attorney General that we have in the room today, he's had a chance to look at the Marquis comments, 14 points, I believe, and he said they're very encouraging and are areas that we can definitely work on. So we will be working with John and the Marquis and others to reach resolution.
Okay. The thing that I think all of us on this committee are particularly concerned with is just making sure that we are taking every step possible that we can to get that the amount of debt down. And I know that there's been a couple of other legislative concepts tossed around, tax amnesty being one of them, and a couple of other things, which I don't know how the rest of the committee feels, but for me the jury's still out on that, because I'm trying to figure out why in the hell should I give somebody an incentive not to pay their taxes by giving them tax amnesty when I'm pretty honest every year and make sure that my taxes are paid by April 15th. And yet some other yo-yo that decides they don't want to pay their taxes, we're gonna cut them a break. Just one of those issues that we all sort of think about. Of course, then when the tables turn and you need to use that, then you're glad that it's there, right? So we always have to be careful what we wish for. But I'm encouraged then to hear that you're all sitting down to kind of work this out. What I would like to do is maybe one more time before our committee closes the end of May would be to ask you to come back and just kind of give us an update in terms of how this is going, and then what we may want to do at that point is just sort of informally through a letter process just kind of refer the biennial stuff onto the Joint Legislative Audits Committee so that we kind of keep track of this and know that the process is being worked on, and hopefully what we'll start seeing is some real positive outcomes with our debt going down and the amount being collected going up, and then everybody's happy because the state has spendable money.
Thank you
very much. Any other questions or comments for our panel?
Thank you
very much. Appreciate it. Appreciate you taking the time to be here today. And let's see, we don't have anything else. Now, just a reminder that on Tuesday, we're going to leave at about, it's the 26th, and we're going to leave at about noon. If for any reason you're not going to be there, please make sure that you let Jim know. Although, if you're not going to be there, be prepared to hear from me. If you need transportation, then make sure that you let Jim know that as well, because he can arrange for transportation for you. Also, if you would like a lunch, Donna up in the house lounge generally has been very kind to fix box lunches or sack lunches for people for the committees when they're going out. So if you would like a box or sack lunch from the lounge, make sure that you let Jim know, because he'll give Donna our final count. And then, let's see, I talked about attendance. I do know that Representative Butler is not going to be able to be there for because of some health-related things that are going on. So anyway, so with that...
What time's the meeting up there?
That's on, pardon?
What time is the meeting?
The actual hearing is going to start at 3, but we're touring the DEQ clean air station starting at 1:30. We slid it back in about 30 minutes because if our floor session goes a little bit long, that still gives us time to make sure that we can get there. And actually, if we do get there early, they may be ready for us and that sort of thing. So,
Chair, are we going to be receiving an agenda for the hearing?
It'll be out today.
Yes. The agenda for the hearing will be out. It will be out today. So you'll be getting that. And this is a joint hearing with the House Environment Committee. And then also the House Environment Committee and the Chair Anderson and I are still working out the complete logistics on this, but I do know that the House Environment Committee does have a couple of bills that they would like to hear up there as well. So, and we'll be meeting, our hearing will actually occur at Middleton Elementary School in Sherwood. So, okay. With that, if any questions, comments, then we will stand adjourned.